Rana Adish is a doctor in the intensive care unit at a big hospital, Henry Ford, in Detroit. And when corona cases started arriving in March, she made up this job for herself. She started spending hours of each day walking the fourth, fifth, and sixth floors that made up the ICU, just checking in on her coworkers, seeing how they were doing. Which means that maybe more than any single person in the hospital, she knows best what the staff has been going through at every stage of this pandemic. And she tries to help. Even, for instance, when a unit clerk tells her that she is short on bleach and wipes.
I'll see if I can poke some people.
Okay, thank you.
I love you.
Love you too.
Miki Meek, on our staff, is the person who first reached out to Rena and got to know her. Hey there, Miki.
Hey, Ira. So one of the things that's new about coronavirus is how much death the doctors and nurses see. It's relentless. And Rena especially worries about the doctors who are still in training. It's their residents and fellows.
All right, Henry Ford is a big teaching hospital.
Yeah, so when Rena was a resident, she says the doctors in charge never checked in with the trainees about their feelings after a patient died. She says it's traumatic. You can feel like you failed them. And Rena says that two of the residents she trained with actually died by suicide. She sometimes still, like, wonders if someone checking in might have made a difference. So, you know, when she heard about a team of Henry Ford trainees who lost a patient, she made a point of stopping by to see them. They were all in this, like, cramped, windowless workroom. It's on the fifth floor.
Hi, you guys. How are you?
How are you? I was trying to write an email to you, but I
That's why we came down, because I figured it was, like, a better talking thing than...
Yeah.
We heard there was a bad day.
There was a young 22-year-old woman who died, and everyone took it pretty bad.
Yeah.
So...
There wasn't a dry eye.
Anywhere.
That's a resident named Reem saying there wasn't a dry eye. I'm not sure I've ever heard doctors talk like this among themselves about what it's like when a patient dies.
I have to say, it's interesting. You've played me this tape, and before this conversation with the trainees even gets started, their leader, Jay Lakshmikant, heads for the door to leave. And Rena kind of blocks him.
You guys can chat. We got to do this thing.
I'm going to walk over here.
Yeah.
So she stands in front of the door, and she opens up this bag of donated scrub caps that have sharks and dinosaurs on them.
Did it make you too sad? Is that why you just took yourself out of the conversation?
All of us.
And then Rena, she turns to that resident, Reem, to get her to say more about her feelings, about this patient who died. They'd taken care of her for a whole month.
What were you sharing about the patient?
Oh, no, it was just, you know, like, she's 22. She's just like one of us. And I was just staring at how beautiful she was.
Yeah.
Like her eyelashes, her nails, her toenails. She worked in the eyelash business. She was, like, we saw her pictures. Her mom shared her pictures with us, and she was so beautiful. She was the hardest case for us, yeah. I don't know, for me personally, I wanted to quit many times. Many days, I would imagine the conversation with Dr. Bray, just telling him, I can't do it anymore.
Aww.
It's almost over. I'm so sorry.
We all have those days. We literally all have those days. It's... crazy what we expect of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I've cried on rounds multiple times. I've had to leave, take a break, cry, and then come back. It's just really hard.
We chose Henry Ford Hospital because it's in Detroit, a city that's 80% Black. Black Americans have been dying of COVID-19 at higher rates than anybody else. In Michigan, they are four times more likely to die than whites. Henry Ford usually gets a mix of Black and white patients from all over the Midwest, but with the pandemic, the hospital basically turned into a huge COVID ward for the city of Detroit, and the patients in the ICU were now mostly Black. The staff says the majority were essential workers, bus drivers, police officers, firefighters, sanitation workers, people from grocery stores.
It's personal on a lot of levels.
Dr. Geneva Tatum is one of the few Black doctors in the ICU and one of the senior doctors in the hospital. She's a pulmonologist. Her family moved to Detroit when she was 10. She has deep ties to the city now and a deep awareness of what the virus has done to Black people there.
I mean, I've had friends' parents. I've had multiple church members, multiple community leaders die. You know, when I walk into the ICU and 15 out of 16 patients is, you know, a Black male between the age of 45 and 75. You know, it's really an emotional thing.
Dr. Tatum lives alone. And because of the stress of COVID, she's talking to a therapist for the first time, her cousin.
She has way more phone calls with me than she would probably care to admit, I probably owe her thousands of dollars in counseling money at this point.
We started recording the staff at this hospital in mid-April because we wanted to see what it is like for them to be going for so long in this intense and difficult situation. The day in mid-April that we started talking to Rena and the doctors at Henry Ford was the very first day that the number of people admitted to the ER was fewer than the day before. It was the very first day after their peak, and the number of COVID patients has slowly dropped since then. We wanted to follow our hospital staff over time because we wanted to see how they managed and adapted and adjusted and just what it did to them personally. And so we did regular calls with nurses and doctors on the Henry Ford staff for 2.5 months. And what we're going to bring you this hour are the moments that just really struck us and surprised us of all sorts. From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life. Stay with us. Robin Semien is the producer on our staff who talked to Dr. Tatum, who you just heard. And Dr. Tatum told her this story that gives a sense of the situation at Henry Ford and in Detroit. Robin will explain.
In our first interview, I asked Dr. Tatum a benign question about COVID patients using FaceTime to talk to their families who can't visit the ICU because the disease is so contagious. And as an answer, she told me a story so harrowing. It speaks to the relentlessness and devastation of the disease on the city, its speed and cruelty. It was about a patient in his early 40s.
Who had Down syndrome, who was being cared for by his sister at home.
His sister had brought him in with COVID symptoms. She was also taking care of her mother, who was also sick with COVID. So she had to drop him off at the hospital by himself.
We bring him in. He's very sick. We bring him into the ICU. You know, we're gowned in masks and face shields and gloves and, you know, that physical barrier between us and him. And we're trying to explain to him what in the world is going on. Mm. You know, he doesn't understand it. He just sees a bunch of people dressed this way and is scared, confused, wondering where his sibling is, what's happening, why he needs to wear oxygen. And then that's when it dawned on us. We have to figure out a way pretty quickly to help him understand.
So they used FaceTime. This was one of the first times Henry Ford used it with COVID patients. It was still early in the pandemic. Dr. Tatum and her team got the man's sister on the phone, on video, so she could explain to her brother how sick he was and why the oxygen was necessary. And then she told the doctors what might help her brother relax.
You know, his favorite TV channel is this. His favorite TV program is that. He likes this for a snack. He likes these things for activities. And so we were able pretty quickly to get those things that he needed to kind of, you know, create the environment as close to normal as it can be in an isolation room, if you will.
And did that work? Did it calm him down?
It absolutely did. It absolutely did.
Meanwhile, she says his mom was at a different hospital with COVID, and her condition was worsening. His sister was monitoring them both from home and calling her brother all the time to check on him and keep his spirits up. Was she giving updates to her brother about how their mom was doing, or was that like a bridge too far?
That was a bridge too far.
Oh, wow. So he really didn't know that his mom was sick,
no,
basically?
And you know, the sad thing in this case is actually because the sister who was his caregiver was both taking care of him and his mother, she got ill.
The staff found this out by accident. One day they needed the sister's help.
And we kept calling and couldn't get an answer. And then after multiple attempts, another sibling called and said, hey, you know, I'm so-and-so's, you know, other sister, and the reason why you haven't been able to get in touch with my sister is because she has now passed away.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
I'm not really sure if he knows that his sister, who's his caregiver, has passed away.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, because it, you know, so it was devastating to us as a team when we heard about that, you know, because again, this is the aftermath of what we're seeing. And to know that, you know, his sister, who's, you know, spent her life, you know, making sure that he was okay, you know, wound up dying from the very disease that we're treating him for was really, really difficult. And this is what we've been seeing over and over again. You know, the person who gets admitted to the ICU who, you know, tells us, yeah, well, my spouse is also sick, or my daughter or son is also sick. You know, we've had instances where we've had multiple family members of just one family, you know, in our ICUs. So it's really difficult. And something I don't think any of us could have even emotionally prepared ourselves for.
At its peak, COVID spread through Detroit like an invisible wildfire. Entire homes, neighborhoods, unrecognizable afterwards. The man Dr. Tatum treated was moved to rehab to recover from what COVID did to his body. What it did to his life is different. There's no rehab for that.
Robin Semyon's a producer on our show. Act One, God Bless America. In April, when we first started talking to the staff at Henry Ford, the intensive care unit was struggling with something they had never seen before. All these patients who were just not getting better. These were COVID patients who would either die or they'd stay stuck on ventilators for weeks, and the staff had no idea how to get them off. When that Dr. Red Ondish, who we heard at the beginning of the show, would circulate through the hospital, talking to staff and checking in, they all knew that she has a very particular approach to medicine and to patient care. Mickey Meek, welcome back.
Hey again, Ira. So yeah, Rena's whole approach to medicine comes out of an experience she had back in 2008. She was a doctor here at Henry Ford, and then she landed in her own ICU as a patient. She had multi-system organ failure, went on a ventilator. And she told me her coworkers acted like she couldn't hear them, but she actually could.
What shocked and upset me the most was overhearing a resident in the hallway say, "She's trying to die on me." Hearing in the operating room, "She's circling the drain."
That sounds so scary to hear that.
Yeah. It was so difficult to imagine my own recovery when everyone around me was talking about me as if I was dying. But, you know, I had said similar things.
"She's circling the drain."
Yeah. It was a culture of bravado, and it was showing that you were untouched by suffering. It was that it didn't matter. One of the things I've always felt sort of ashamed about is that our patients have been telling us these things for years.
When she recovered, she returned to her job at the hospital with a new mindset. It was all about empathy. That empathy would make her a better doctor, not worse, which was the opposite of her training. She'd been taught that too much feeling clouds a doctor's judgment. She and a small team revamped the way the whole system talks to patients, and Rena wrote a book about her experience that's now used in medical schools. But when COVID hit their ICU, it became impossible for the staff to do some of the things Rena put in place. Like before COVID, when someone arrived unconscious or sedated into the ICU, they'd always ask the family, "What do you think your loved one would want me to know about them?" Families would put up photos and bring in quilts, personalize the rooms. And the staff, they liked that. They really wanted to get to know the person they'd be caring for. But under COVID, all that was impossible. Families could no longer come in and get to know the staff.
I had one nurse tell me just yesterday, "I feel like all of my patients are the same."
Like, what does that mean, all the same?
In this case, they all have COVID pneumonia. They're all prone. They're all on the ventilator. And so there was the risk of depersonalization for the patients.
She said getting to know their patients was a part of their job that they really got a lot of satisfaction out of. But they didn't totally realize that until COVID took it away.
This change throughout the hospital was biggest for the nurses. They're the ones who spend the most time with COVID patients. And our next story is about the nursing staff in pod 4. The ICU in Henry IV is broken up into these pods. Pod 4 was kind of the front line in the hospital's COVID-19 effort. It was the very first pod designated as all coronavirus patients before the other ICU pods also became all COVID all the time. Ben Calhoun spent weeks talking to the nurses in pod 4.
By mid-April, the nurses in pod 4 had adapted to the alternate universe of COVID-19, at least in certain ways. What I mean, take just the PPE. That's the personal protective equipment they had to wear to go into COVID rooms. This was a high-stakes thing. At this point, people had seen 10 ICU staff get COVID. Two colleagues were on ventilators. One nurse had died. Some people got superstitious about, I always put on my gloves in this order. I always wear a scrub cap under the paper cap, and then I won't get sick. What I didn't get about the PPE until talking to the nurses in pod 4 was the mundane, relentless, crazy-makingness of the very gear keeping them safe. This arduous ritual of rubber gloves, tie-up gowns, P100 respirators that look like gas masks, clear plastic face shields. It took 5 minutes to put it on to go into a room. 5 to 8 minutes to take it off when you come out. You might have to do this as many as 24 or more times every single shift. How long it took to get into a room because of all the PPE is actually a good example of how COVID changed what it was like for people to do even just the basic and normal parts of their jobs. It was hard in the new world of COVID to even communicate with these patients, to explain where they were and what was happening, and to reassure them, and to connect with them in the way that they're used to, the way Rena Oddish talks about. They were still puzzling out the ways to do that. These patients, many of them were sedated, alone in a room with the nonstop sound of the ventilator, which is loud. It's like a vacuum. So nurses had to shout through their P100 mask, which is like a gas mask, and a clear plastic face shield over the roar of the ventilator.
Hey, sir, do you know where you are right now? You're at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. Do you know that? Okay. Do you know what you're here for? You're being treated for COVID-19, the coronavirus right now, okay? Are you in any pain right now?
In April, a month and a half into all of this, the nurses from pod 4 seem like people who are in the throes of a crisis, but also like people who are used to crises. Evan Guffey's a nurse in pod 4. The first time I talked to him, I asked how he was holding up.
I'm good. Yeah. You know, I have a good ability to kind of leave work at work. So, you know, the second I leave, I can kind of just not think about it. But I'm holding up good.
Sarah Davis is another nurse in pod 4. She's got the same kind of ICU nurse toughness, which I sort of grew up around. My mom was a neonatal ICU nurse. She talks like Evan, who talks like Sarah.
I think kind of what I do and most of us do, like, you're in the ICU, things are hard. What I kind of say is you put your pants on and you do it. You can't complain about it. That's going to make it worse, and you got to do it.
By May, a month later, things change. Now it seems likely that pod 4 patients who'd been stuck on life support for weeks, most of them would probably never recover. Evan was used to helping patients get better or giving them a dignified death. Now he felt like he was seeing too many situations that were neither. The nurses had not seen this coming. When I talk to Evan Guffey in May, he tells me about what he's struggling with the most, that families are continuing to tell them to do everything they can to save patients, which he gets. But there's a patient who kind of typifies what he's seeing, a man, several underlying health issues, who's been stuck on life support for weeks. He's heavily sedated, breathing tube down his throat. Eventually, the man's kidneys give out, so he's on constant dialysis. His lungs also give out. And even when they stop sedating him, he remains unresponsive.
It's like, you know, what are we, you know, what are we doing here? We're just continuing to, you know, make these people suffer in a way. It's tough to see those people suffering every day, hooked up to all of these different lines and tubes, and they're essentially unresponsive. And we know, you know, if we were to cut a couple of the interventions off, you know, they would pass away very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it causes a lot of frustration with the nursing staff. You know, because we feel like, you know, we're prolonging the inevitable. You know, some of the frustration got brought up yesterday. You know, we had one of our nurses talking with the physicians, you know, about like, well, when is enough? Like, when are we done? You know?
Evan means that the caring thing would be to let them die.
I don't know, Ben. I don't know.
It sounds like everyone, like from what I could tell from the rounding, they're just really frustrated. They feel like they're torturing people.
They
now.
Do, very much. I actually was
around the same time, Rena Oddish checked in with Aaron Dix, Evan and Sarah's boss. They were standing outside the nurse's break room, talking about exactly what Evan was saying.
Because they feel like they're doing wrong. Like, yeah. They feel like they're preventing the inevitable, and everything that we do is not doing anything. You know, and they're like, this isn't right. Like, I feel, you know, they start to feel guilt. Like, yeah.
They talk about how pod four nurses are stuck in the worst position in medicine. They're caught in the middle between patients who they worry are suffering, who are clearly dying, and their families who are holding out hope.
They don't understand it.
It's so abstract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, we wouldn't believe any of this if we weren't here, right?
No, it's hard. I mean, you don't, unless you're sitting here a day in and day out, you know, and living it every day. You don't understand it. You can't have the feelings that we all have. And so it's...
I've been wondering if there's anything we should try to prepare to do differently, maybe before the next wave.
Yeah, I know, which is going to
I hate
come.
To even say
I know,
it.
I know.
Like, if there are different timelines for these conversations.
By these conversations, Rena means conversations with patients' families. She wonders if doctors and nurses need to change the language they're using with them, like when a patient isn't getting better.
We were talking about this the other day. I think it's how we say things. Instead of saying when they're that sick, instead of saying we've seen progress today, maybe we say we've seen a change today, you know, and this is what we've seen.
Because it creates false hope.
Right. Yeah. And so I don't want to instill that, like, oh my God, they're getting better because they're still so crazy sick. But if we say it differently, you know.
Yeah, because we're so eager to give good news, right? Like, we want to. And so we, yeah. But sometimes it's false.
Yeah, because they can change.
No, that's a really wise insight.
Yeah, they can change so rapidly. So I think that's the challenge.
So. We're asking a lot of everyone. Mm-hmm. A lot.
Yeah.
That same week, this is week 9, one of the nurses I talked to, Sarah Davis, she had a day where two patients died, and neither of them had family in the room with them. The first was a man. He was intubated, so he couldn't speak. Sarah stood with a doctor and held an iPad wrapped in a plastic bag in front of the face of this dying man as a woman said goodbye to him.
And just hearing that conversation with that woman who was talking to the patient who couldn't speak back to her, you know, just saying how much that she loved him and that it was a pleasure to have him in her life. And, you know, it was just really, it was just so much sadness.
In normal times, Sarah wouldn't even be witnessing this kind of private moment. I think families would come into the room, doctors and nurses would leave. The second death, this is the same shift. Sarah and others in pod 4 gathered outside the room of a man who was dying alone. And they prayed with the man's son, who was on speakerphone.
So that, you know, that was hard.
Probably less than an hour after that, Sarah says, the other patient, the man with the iPad, A couple family members were supposed to be there when he died, but things went wrong. The family told the hospital, take his ventilator tube out, and we'll be there to say goodbye at 7:30. So not long before 7:30, Sarah was in the room, and he was extubated. But then, this man starts dying much faster than normal, and his family is not there yet.
So I was waiting for them to come, but while I was waiting for them to come, I was making him comfortable, and I stayed with him while he died before his family came. So, and he ended up passing right before his family came.
I can't stress enough how different this is from Sarah's normal job, being alone with a dying patient. Since COVID, it's common for nurses, though, in hospitals everywhere. With this man, Sarah stood by herself and held his hand and stroked his head. She told him he did a good job, as she stared through the window, hoping desperately that his family would appear.
And then I came home, and you'd appreciate this because of your kids, and I thought I was okay, and I had come home. My kids are normally asleep, and I just peeked in the room that they were in, and they both were looking like they were sleeping. I was just kind of looking at them, crying. And then they were both up, and my son was like, oh, are you sad? And I start bawling my eyes out. And I was like, yeah, it was a sad day. And he knows what I do, and we called the virus the world bug, and he asked if somebody died, and so I told him, yeah, and I just, like, in six-year-old terms, you know, that I was with him and that he was comfortable. And so that was probably the saddest day that I've had.
Around the same time, early May, COVID cases have finally receded enough that parts of the hospital are starting to go back to normal. Non-COVID floors are reopening. People who have been furloughed are coming back to work. Specialists who'd been assigned to COVID ICUs go back to their normal jobs. Even the deli reopens. Some people tell Rena that they're surprised to find themselves feeling upset about other parts of the hospital going back to normal. Not because they're jealous, but because it makes them feel like this awful thing they'd all gone through is being erased. And for the staff of Pod 4, with their 16 ICU beds, they're still 100% COVID patients. And the COVID patients are going to keep coming. Rena talked to Miki about it.
I'm not seeing relief. I'm seeing sadness. And that's the thing that's starting to settle in, is this is ours.
The release valve isn't coming anytime soon.
Right. The group of, I think, doctors and nurses who are caring for these patients are going to be the group of doctors and nurses caring for these patients for the next 2 years. And I don't know if we've wrapped our minds around yet.
COVID was this brutal new normal, stretching out all the way to the horizon of the foreseeable future.
Coming up, okay, your dad comes off a ventilator. His life has been saved. What is the very first thing he says to you? We hear what happened in one family. That's in a minute from Chicago Public Radio when our program continues. Thank you. This American Life, Myra Glass. Today's show, The Reprieve, stories of coronavirus at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, not when they were busiest and things were the worst, but in the weeks since, as the number of cases steadily declined. What you're hearing this hour is when things were less awful. I should say before we go any further that, of course, this past week, COVID-19 cases across the country have been on the rise, including in Michigan. Anyway, in the first half of our show, we focused mostly on the staff of the hospital. In this half, we turned to the people that they tried to save. We've arrived at Act 2 of our show, Act 2, Granger in a Strange Land. So Robert Granger was in Pod 4 for 3 weeks. He got close with one of the nurses, Sarah Davis. She's the nurse that you heard earlier who saw 2 people die in a single day. She had a special connection with Mr. Granger and attached a lot of hope to his case. They talked about his wife, who died of cancer in January, and how hard his family had taken it. He also talked about his grown daughter, Jocelyn. And as he got sicker, Sarah really pushed him to phone Jocelyn. Here's Sarah.
I was like, we're calling her. No, I don't want to. I was like, we're calling her. So, but what was really interesting about him and his daughter was, as he was talking to his daughter, he was being so tough, but at the same time crying. His wife had just passed away, not from COVID. And he was doing everything that he possibly could because he didn't want his daughter to lose dad.
Emmanuel Berry put together this story about Robert Granger and his daughter, Jocelyn.
Jocelyn's in her 20s and her dad's in his 60s. He works for the city fixing buses. And we called her one Friday and said he needed to go to the hospital.
I'm like, that's all I need to know. Hung up, ran down, speeded on my way to his house because I was scared. I'm like, I think he has it.
Yeah, what was that? What was that car ride like?
He probably was scared because I probably was driving like the dragster at Cedar Point. Like, it was to the point to where I'm like, I need to get him there because I'm thinking, like, I'm hearing all over the news that they're running out of supplies. And I'm like, I need to get him in there just in case he needs a ventilator. And he was like, you know how fast you're going. And I'm like, okay, reality. And then spike back up. And I literally just remember drifting into the emergency because I seen the tent, had my mask on. He was in the back seat, just to social distance from me. And then the last thing he said to me was, if I get out of here, if you're taking me home, don't drive like this when we go back.
But she can't take him home. He has COVID. And he's taken to ICU pod 4. As the days pass, he gets worse. The medications don't seem to work. His breathing becomes more labored. And then, on Jocelyn's birthday,
I get a call from him saying, like, hey, I might be put on a ventilator. And I'm like, oh, no, because the doctors are telling me the last thing they want to do is put him on a ventilator because most people are not making him out. So I'm freaking out. Then it turns out it was a false alarm. And then a few days later, I get a phone call and he just said, it's not looking so good. And it almost sounded like he whispered it to me because he couldn't breathe.
Like, how do you react to that?
When I say it took so much muscle to not have my voice crack because I was getting ready to sob, I'm like, okay, Dad, I'll talk to you soon.
Why didn't you want your voice to crack on the phone or for your dad to hear you getting upset?
Because if, just like my mom, if I worry, he worries.
That's what he said about you.
Is that why he said he didn't want to? He had to keep his composure too?
Yeah, he didn't want you to worry.
Told her that, you know, I love her. And that I'm about to go on a ventilator and I don't know what's going to happen. And I just told her, you know, let the family know and talk to our minister. And they came in and they put me on it.
This is her dad, Robert. Though I'm going to call him Mr. Granger because that's what Sarah Davis called him, and it's just a solid dad name. The nurses told us they often wondered what this all looked like from the patient's side. Here's how it looked for Mr. Granger. When he was rolled into the ICU, he says he felt like he was inside a fishbowl. Lots of windows, lots of people staring at him through those windows, including Sarah Davis.
Sarah stands out the most. I just remember her a lot of times looking through the window. And a lot of the nurses and one nurse in particular will hold up a little piece of paper and say, we're praying for you. As I started getting a little worse, I noticed just the doctors were, they didn't come in at first. They would just look, they would just look through the window, look at me, wave, and then look at the meter at my vitals.
What did it feel like to just have people looking?
I didn't know what to think at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then one doctor came in and he sat down and he asked me, what did I think? And I say, well, I'm thinking things are not too good.
This is when the doctors told Mr. Granger they might have to put him on a ventilator.
And I said, if I'm on it for a reasonable amount of time and things don't look good, take me off.
Was it easy for you to make that decision or?
No, but it's a decision I wanted to make. I didn't want my daughter to have to make that. So going through my head is at that time, I didn't, you know, they didn't know whether I was going to make it or not. And the only thing I can think of is, wow, my, you know, we just went to losing my wife and my daughter's losing her mother. Now, if she loses me, she's really going to be devastated. Because my daughter, she's an emotional person.
On that phone call about the ventilator, Dad was trying to protect his daughter by being tough. Daughter was trying to protect Dad by doing the same thing. But neither of them was conscious of this until Sarah, the nurse, who was getting to know them both, pointed it out. Here's Jocelyn.
She just asked me, like, you know, how was that? Like, how did you stay so strong? And I said, girl, when I hung up, I was not strong at all. I let it out. She was like, your dad literally said the same thing. And I was like, go figure. And that's when I realized my mom was the sweetest person ever. And I used to think I got the kindest thing where I can't say no to helping people. I used to think I got it from her. I got it from him. And I was just like, it just made me feel more guilty. And I'm like, wow, I really wish I took the time to get closer to you equally as much as my mom.
For 10 days, he's on a ventilator and she wonders if she'll ever have more time with him. And then she calls and he's off the vent. So when she calls to check in on him a week or so in her head, he's sleeping on a vent. But the nurse who answers the phone says, oh, he's off the vent. And he was. She gets him on the phone.
And then, like, you know, one of the first things he asked me when he answered the phone to tell me that he was off the ventilator? He literally asked me, did I need any money? I'm like, are you serious right now? I'm like, no. I'm like, it just kind of like, you know how someone does like a personality quirk, it just sums up their whole character? That was it. I was like, wow, you literally just died and came back. And the first thing you ask is, do you need any money?
After 4 weeks in the hospital, Mr. Granger was discharged to a rehab center. When he was well enough to come home from there, Jocelyn went to pick him up. She made sure to get all her crying done in the car before she got there.
I did. Like, I try not to cry because I hate crying in front of my dad.
I do too.
Because I feel like, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, don't cry, don't cry. And when I seen him, he looked different in a good way. Like, my dad never had a beard before. So I was like, wow, you have a beard. And he looked so, like, thin. Not, like, in, like, a bad way. It, like, you could tell he lost a lot of weight. And I said, I'm like, wow, if mom could have seen you now. It just felt like we just kind of pressed play. It's like, you know how, like, you play a CD and it just skips? And you're just in some random scene. Like, I felt like I was just, like, in a random splash of happiness. Like, it just didn't happen. Like, once I got him in that car, it felt like it didn't happen.
Mr. Granger's at home, but still in recovery. When I talked to him, he could walk up to 9 minutes at a time. He's hoping to make it around the block soon, without a walker.
Emmanuel Barry. Act three, Mr. Eastside. Some of the first COVID patients to arrive at Henry Ford were police and others who'd attended a community breakfast in early March called Police and Pancakes. And we were especially interested in the story of that breakfast and those patients because it illustrates the scale of loss outside the hospital walls, the scale of loss in the city of Detroit. Aaron Foley is from the city. He used to work as the city's chief storyteller, a position in the mayor's office that focuses on Detroiters telling their own narratives. He has this story of the breakfast and of one man in particular who ended up at Henry Ford.
I'm going to take you to the east side of Detroit for a minute, which is hard for me to do as a West Sider. But I'll let it slide, because I want to tell you the story of someone who embodied everything the city's east side is made of, Marlo Stoudemire. The east side is where some of the first Black Detroiters were able to legally purchase homes. And it includes some of Detroit's best attractions, like Belle Isle, which is something like our Central Park. But it also includes zip code 48205, which, in addition to diehard loyalists, has had one of the highest crime rates in the city. The policing in that zip code, and in the rest of the city, included so much excessive force that the Detroit Police Department, the DPD, was put under a consent decree for years. And ever since, police have been trying to establish a better relationship with the community. The Police and Pancakes breakfast was part of that. The precinct there, the 9th precinct, held the breakfast to highlight the progress that had been made and to try to get more voices in the conversation about police, like young people, pastors, and business owners. It was at Fisher Magnet Upper Academy, a table in the entryway for name tags, and long buffet tables where heated trays of hash browns, eggs, and, of course, pancakes are waiting. Letty Azar, who works in the mayor's office handling community affairs on the east side, was speaking that day. When she arrived, she started looking around the room to see who's here, looking around at all the different police, worried that the message of the breakfast won't come across.
And then I saw Marlo, and that was a big reassurance that, in fact, it was going to be a good day and a great event.
Marlo is a community staple in Detroit. He had been tapped to help organize this event and host one of the portions of the breakfast as well. Letty worked with him a lot last year, side by side, intense community meetings, where he put people at ease and got their trust, though she hadn't seen him in a few months.
But I remember him walking through the entry door, and he gave me the biggest hug and lifted me right off of my feet. And we were both so excited to do this together.
One of the other people Marlo ran into was my friend Adam Hollier. We went to high school together. Now he's a state senator, representing part of the east side. So he's always at events like the pancake breakfast. But today, he wasn't giving out any hugs.
I was taking COVID-19 very seriously. People were like foot tapping or elbow bumping, but I wasn't. I was trying to keep my distance with folks just because my mother had recently got through chemo and I was, you know, operating under an abundance of caution throughout this process.
And then he saw Marlo and he forgot all that.
Nobody has a quick interaction with Marlo Stoudemire. I mean, you know, that's a guy that makes you feel like you matter, right? A good friend of mine was teasing, they're like, Marlo's that hustle guy who found his way to work in the system, not on the outside of it. It's just like, hey, I need 5 turkeys or I need to get, you know, these kids from this practice to this practice. And then all of a sudden you need a referee. It's like, well, where are you going to get a referee? You just call Marlo.
Everybody has a story about Marlo. And Marlo seemed to know everybody who was trying to make life better for Black Detroit. He'd host these people on a makeshift talk show he did on Facebook Live.
I want to talk to you about a special guest that I have today. She's killing it right now in a major way. Brittany Rhodes, yeah, that's her, is the founder of Black Girl Mathjic, right? It's math and magic.
I first met Marlo when we were both invited to speak at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for a panel about Detroit, of course. I just started working for the mayor's office as chief storyteller, and I was getting some backlash because the mayor is white and I'm not. I had a long career as a journalist, and the mayor hired me during an election year. People said I sold out. I heard rumors about me that I was just hired on to finesse the mayor's image, and because of that, I didn't know who in Detroit I could trust. That very first time I met him, Marlo sensed something was wrong with me during that trip to Boston. So he got me to open up. He was disarming, and I shared with him some of the mixed emotions I was having about what people were saying about me back home, He told me, and I quote, "That really pisses me the f*** off that people would say that about you. And if anybody has anything to say about it, we're going to deal with them." I never forgot that. Marlo told me to f*** him. His words. He told me that folks are rooting for me. Folks are watching me. Folks are wanting me to do well. And that he was excited for me. And he was counting on me. Just weeks after the breakfast, Marlo Stoudemire would become the first person in Detroit publicly identified as dying from the virus.
Yo, yo, yo. Good morning, Detroit. Good morning. This is Marlo Stoudemire with another edition of Saturday Morning Coffee at another location, as you will see and find out in a few minutes.
Here he is the day after the Police and Pancakes week. Breakfast, discussing the event on his makeshift talk show, which he hosted every Saturday on Facebook Live.
I had the privilege of being invited by Justin Kempson at the Fort Resource and Engagement Center. Shout out to Justin. Over on the east side, to facilitate a conversation between the community and the Detroit Police Department. And it was called Police and Pancakes. And the cool thing about it was is that they brought in the different police and different community stakeholders. And the whole conversation was how to create a better community experience with the Detroit Police Department.
And so on that video, he also talked about his health. This was before COVID really hit Detroit. It wasn't on most people's minds. And he chalked it up to his lifestyle. Hustling, grinding, always going hard, 24/7.
I ran into one of my frat brothers over the weekend, last weekend. And he said, "Man, you know, I really like the stuff that you're doing, the moves you're making out here, and all these other different things. But one of the things that he talked about was, he said, make sure you take care of yourself. He said, you need to find a way to have self-care. And what's interesting is that this week was a week where I felt bad. I had a few health challenges. I had a procedure done this week. And I realized that I hadn't been taking care of myself. So I need to make some adjustments."
No one knows exactly how COVID started spreading through Detroit. But law enforcement was hit hard in the beginning, and dozens of officers were at Police and Pancakes. At its height, more than 500 DPD employees were quarantined to contain the spread. About a fifth of the force. After Police and Pancakes, the Detroit Health Department began letting attendees know that they may have been exposed to the virus. People started wondering if they were carriers and who they might be passing it on to. Harley had left Police and Pancakes and went back to school. Letty left for another community event in District 4. Adam went to mingle with some pretty big names.
As soon as I left the breakfast, I went over to the Joe Biden office opening, the Joe Biden for President piece. And so, you know, was there with the LG.
The Lieutenant Governor.
Representative Yancey and Tate and former Governor Blanchard as we kind of kicked off the office. And I drove up to Cornell and then kind of came back. And that Monday night, we had the big Joe Biden rally at Renaissance. And that was, you know, the last big event that I had gone to. But at that same moment, you know, I bump into Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and, you know, a host of congressional members and I'm with the governor.
Marlo once worked at Henry Ford as community and diversity manager and later director of international business strategy. When he got there in March, he was one of the first patients treated for COVID-19 in Pod 4 in the ICU. His time there was short. He died on March 24th. Someone from work, a mutual friend, called Letty with the news.
Was he the first person you knew that had passed from it, or?
He was, but interestingly, 3 hours later, I got a call on a DPD friend who had passed away. That's Jonathan Parnell, who was one of our DPD captains. And I've known his family for some time. So he was a great guy, very well-respected police officer and member of the community. So it was Marlo and Recon that day, and then the next day, two more, and then the next day, three more. And that week of March that Marlo passed away was, I hope to never have to live anything like that again. But it was just unbelievable, the number of calls and texts and people you knew that you worked with, you prayed with, you ate with, you grew up with, that you would see at community meetings that you realize you're just never going to see again. we lost so many valuable souls in this city. And to come out of this pandemic, they'd be the first people you turn to say, all right, how do we get everybody, you know, how do we help rebuild some momentum? And they're not there.
Over the next few hours on that day, tributes started to pour in across social media about Marlo, about how Detroit lost a giant, a champion, whatever your preferred term may be, and that there was now a void that couldn't be filled. Who do you call now when you need advice or when you need mentorship? Who calls you when you need to be checked on? Who among us did he leave? And what would he be doing now, in this moment, when racial inequities have been laid bare, not just by the virus, but also by the killing of George Floyd? In Detroit, another name you hear at demonstrations these days is Ayanna Stanley Jones. She was a 7-year-old girl from the East Side who was killed in a police raid while she slept on a couch back in 2010. Adam Hollier, my friend the state rep, says Marlo would be jumping in right now to help realize the goals of Black Lives Matter wherever the biggest need is.
Oh, Marlo, I mean, Marlo is the type of person who would have been in the forefront, but he'd also have been someone that white people would have been reaching out to, right? They'd say, well, how can I be helping? He'd be like, well, you can do these three things, right? They'd say, I got this organization that is doing this work. You can donate. Your business could hire more Black people. You can do these things. And I think people are now willing to say that Black Lives Matter. What they aren't willing to say is how much they value them, right? Like, how much do they matter? He would have been uniquely situated to have those conversations with people.
James Fegan IV is another one of those connectors in Detroit who I know knows everybody. Both James and Marlo are around 40. They both grew up on the East Side during that chaotic time in Detroit when crack started to ravage the city. They both built their careers in Detroit, dedicated to Detroit. Where is Marlo missing right now?
You know, this was a question I started thinking about the other day, and it was tough because I'm still mourning, and a lot of us are. But the sad irony that Marlo's last act was at a police and pancakes breakfast on the Far East Side, trying to foster positive relations with young Black males and the police. That's what's missing right now, you know. There's a lot of us who may have had negative experiences with police, but we also got, you know, police in our family, you know, friends. If we could create more forums like that, then it would help everybody. Because our goal is that everybody, you know, number one, stays alive, and number two, like, has a chance to contribute to a better Detroit and a better Black community. And I could just see him right now being that person that would, you know, be as angry as we all are about what happened to George Floyd, but also have some real relationships to point to and lean on.
When I talked to Marlo's wife, Valencia, she didn't want to discuss the final days of her husband's life and says their two children are still adjusting to life without their dad. But she told me this story about an overseas trip they took just this past fall.
We went to Rome in October, and literally we saw the Colosseum, and he was like tearing up, and I'm like, oh babe, you know, what's wrong? You know, he's like, you just don't understand, like, I'm not supposed to be here. Like, this was what I saw in textbooks. This was not real, you know, and here's what had me to believe that it wasn't. It wasn't real for me as a Black male. It wouldn't be my reality to see it. And it was overwhelming to him.
I'm so glad we got to have that experience, but he just, it was very important for him that he beat the odds. And there are so, and it was important to him that not only did he beat them, but all of the young men that looked like him behind him had an opportunity to do the same. And I think that was the most important thing to him.
Last year, Marlo did this thing for 50 days straight, where each day he'd write a Facebook post about two Black people in Detroit he saw potential in, which he later turned into a website called Roster Detroit. This came after a Chamber of Commerce official said that Amazon didn't choose Detroit for its new headquarters, partly because the city didn't have enough talent. Marlo's response was this list to say, here's what you missed out on. Right now, the list of people we've lost to COVID is too long. So too is the list of people we've lost to police brutality. These lists are about Black death. But at this moment, I like to think about Roster Detroit, Marlo's list of Black talent. A list that's about Black people living.
Aaron Foley. He's about to become the head of the Black Media Initiative at the Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York.
I'm looking at this sign in the window. I don't know if y'all can see it. It says, nothing stops Detroit. Nothing stops the people of Detroit, is what I would say. And the point that I'm making is, y'all, look, if not us, then who? And I will tell you right now, it's tough. But the last time I checked, this was the D. And so I will just say, stay motivated, stay connected, and help people. Help people, help people, help people. I'll help you. Hit me up. All right, D. Holla.
It's a cold world, but it's warming up. We ain't got no choice but to run it up. It ain't just one, it's a hundred to us. Might not mean much to you, but mean something to us.
Well, program was produced today by Nikki Meek and Emmanuel Berry. Special thanks today to Michael Eichenhorn, Sarah Hagab, Jackie Flom, Kristen Chastain, Kim North-Shine, Patrick Bradley, Brittany Brown, Lamont James, Tatiana Grant, Melinda Madrigal, Imani Mixon, John Ranishewski, Jeffrey Rowe, Sonia Russell, Marcus Thurkel, Angela Wicks, and Stateline, a journalism project funded by the Pew Charitable Trust. Our website, thisamericanlife.org. This American Life is delivered to public radio stations by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Support for This American Life comes from Progressive Insurance, with a Name Your Price tool, offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive. And from Sitka Salmon Shares, community-supported fishery, home-delivering traceable wild Alaskan seafood since 2011, online ordering, recipes, and more about their small boat fleet at sitkasalmonshares.com. Thanks, as always, to our program's co-founder, Mr. Tori Malatia. You know, he actually met Donald Trump once. This was years ago. Kind of a weird story.
He literally asked me, did I need any money?
I'm Ira Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.
It's a cold world, but it's warming up. We ain't got no choice but to run it up. It ain't just one, it's a hundred to us. Might not mean much to you, but mean something to us. It's a cold world.